I'm going to call the Tax Committee to order. The tape's on. Okay. And Representative Davids, I can't do anything because we don't have a quorum, so maybe you should just tell us what you're going to do this weekend while we wait for a quorum. And I'm trying to get the message out to members to come down so we can get a quorum. Representative Davids?
I don't think I should say what I'm doing this weekend.
Okay. All right. Is there anything else you want to talk about?
Oh, I'll help the largest landowner in Fillmore County with some fencing, I believe.
Oh, okay. Well,
see, that's why I have to be so nice to him, because he owns half my county.
Representative Hansen owns your county?
Well, a good part of it, I should say.
He is a farmer.
Yeah. Well, Danger and Granger is what we say.
What are you selling for down here?
Lots. Lots.
Yes. Okay, well, you know what?
Chair?
Yes.
I can tell you that I'm a new grandmother for the first time as of Friday.
Congratulations.
Yeah. First time?
First time, yeah.
Oh, yay.
While we debated the tax bill.
Boy or girl?
Wow.
Boy or girl.
Girl.
Little girl.
Oh, does she have a name yet?
Annika.
Her name is
Refund. Nice.
Oh, PTR.
Oh. Well, congratulations. That's wonderful.
Thanks.
That is wonderful. We are still going to wait for a quorum so that we can move these bills and lay them over. And you know, I don't know. I think after everything everyone's been through in the last tax bill, people are a little worn out. But we do have to get to the next one. And I should say, members, we're going to release the next tax bill tomorrow and mark it up on Thursday. And so if there's anything people are still working on, now's the time to try to persuade people. So, you know, I think people have known. We've delayed the release of the bill twice, so people kind of know where we're at with that. Where are members? We need members. I don't know. How many do we need? We can drag two, three people in here. We're probably standing out in the hall.
We should actively recruit members.
Yes. Well, we can go to our presenters, but I would rather wait until we've taken care of the housekeeping stuff, because I really want people to hear this presentation, which will be excellent. So, if not, we're just going to sit here and wait until members arrive.
Maybe I can get Pep and Don. You want to do Pep and see where Pep is? Yeah, I'll see where Pep is. We're working for you, Madam Chair, here.
We're recruiting.
Good, thank you. Thank you.
We need you.
Yeah, we'll just wait. We'll start. If they don't come in a couple minutes, we'll start. But we really do.
Or not.
There we go. A couple more.
We can start now.
It has been an exhausting couple of weeks in taxes, so I understand that. So a former tax committee member sitting there, but that doesn't count. We count former tax committee members in the audience. No, I don't think so. Okay. Is that another live one?
Yeah.
Okay. We need one more person.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Does the member who comes in and makes quorum get a prize, anything like that?
Here he is. There he goes. Okay, so we were trying to get a quorum, so we appreciate you being here. And so, members, I'm going to refer down these bills to division. House File 3249, House File 3245, 3218, 3192, 3142, 3116, 3086, 3082, 3024, 3022, 2975, 2971, 2963. And those are sent down to division. We have three bills on the calendar that we just want to move before us and lay them over. So I'm going to go, because they're on the reserve, and folks know we worked on this last week. I'm going to move House File 1982 before the committee. That was the Earhart Reserve Bill, and we're going to lay that over. I'm going to move House File 3170 before the committee and lay that over, and I'll now move House File 3167 and lay that over. So that covers it, members, except for an approval of the minutes, and then we can go to our presentation.
So move, Madam Chair.
So Representative Davids moves the minutes. Discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The minutes are adopted. Thank you. Okay, great. Members, so now the point of why we're really here today is to hear a couple from a couple presenters who I think folks will find this information extremely interesting and helpful to all of us in the Minnesota legislature. As everybody here knows, the Senate added a reserve language provision to the tax bill we sent over, and the House and Senate and the governor worked on that, and so we now have some brand new reserve language, and I think we'll ask Ms. Manzi, if she's still here, to maybe tell us what that was. But then we want to go to the presenters, and just a word on them, members. I attended a fiscal leaders conference with all four caucuses had folks who were invited to that, and it was a compilation of Pew Charitable Trust, the MacArthur Foundation, and MCSL, I think, if I have that right. And I heard a couple of the people who are here today and was so impressed with their work on both how states should look at reserves and the volatility of their tax revenue. So they're here with us today, combined with MMB, to talk to us about, you know, what people should be thinking about in state legislatures on these issues. So we'll hear from them as soon as Ms. Manzi tells us, just to, for us to all recall, what was in House File 1777 that was signed by the governor. So Ms. Manzi.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the three bills that you have before you in committee today all include elements of what was enacted into law as part of House File 1777 last week. The things that House File 1777 did with regard to the budget reserve were to transfer $150 million to the reserve on July 1st, 2014, make a corresponding increase in the level set for the reserve amount in the section of statute with the headnote additional revenues, semicolon priorities, which gives instruction to the commissioner of MMB about what to do with budget surpluses and economic forecasts. There are five priorities. Well, there were five priorities there. Now there are four. The first priority is to fill up the cash flow account to $350 million. The second priority is to fill up the budget reserve account, and that had been up to $653 million prior to Friday's bill signing. Now that amount has been increased to $810,992,000, which corresponds to the $653 million that was in previous law plus the $150 million transferred. The next two priorities have to do with the school shift and the property tax recognition shift, both of which have been fully satisfied. And then the final priority that's in that section was stricken in House File 1777, which was restoration of funds that had been transferred to the general fund from the state airports fund. So that was amended. And then the next thing that happened is that the state is going to have a designated desired level for the reserve, which is going to be based on a percentage of general fund non-dedicated revenues as specified in a report on the budget reserve that MMB prepares annually, and that report's prepared in January of the year. Mr. Schupner, I think, may speak a little more about that report later today. And then the last thing that it does is to provide that after those first four priorities have been satisfied, then in each November forecast, 33% or one-third of any remaining surplus is transferred to the budget reserve until it gets to that desired target level that's set based on MMB's report.
Great. Thank you. Appreciate that so much. And we're going to ask Ms. Murphy and Ms. Erford to join us at the table. And, you know, members, as they're coming up, I should tell you, if you know, take a look at this folder that's in your packets from Pew Charitable Trust. This information is so great for legislators. I wish we would spend more time looking at the work of some of these organizations that are available to all legislators these nonpartisan organizations that are just, you know, trying to assist legislators and states to make good fiscal decisions. And the information provided here, there's just, it's just a lot of excellent information, and the two presenters' cards are in there as well. So if you have questions even beyond this hearing, I hope you will call them. And welcome to the committee. I don't know if Ms. Murphy or Ms. Erford wants to start first, but welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you very much for having us. I think that for the presentation part of this, I'll be doing most of the speaking. My name is Brenna Erford. I'm with the Pew Charitable Trusts, and my colleague Mary Murphy and I both work on state budget policy. For the Q&A section afterwards, we're both available to address any questions you may have. So thank you very much to the chairs and the committee as a whole for inviting us to present today. Let me tell you a little bit about Pew if you are not familiar with our work. The Pew Charitable Trusts is an organization driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems. We apply a rigorous analytical approach to improve public policy, inform the public, and stimulate civic life. And my colleagues and I at Pew would like to commend you, first and foremost, for taking the opportunity provided by your current budget outlook to consider how to best strengthen your rainy day policies. Mary and I have been watching a lot of proposals to change the way Minnesota saves for its rainy days surface over the course of your session to date. Of course, we're aware that House File 1777 was signed into law. And it's our hope that our research and recommendations can help inform further reserve mechanisms you may put in place to strengthen those policies moving forward. So with forecasted surpluses on the horizon and repayment of the recession-driven school funding shift behind you, this is absolutely the right time for you to be thinking about when, how, and how much to save to soften the impact of your next inevitable revenue downturn. Before the recession hit in 2008, you'd built up just over $1 billion in your combined reserve accounts, which was an amount equivalent to about 5.5% of your total tax revenues for that year. But in 2009 alone, our research shows that Minnesota's tax revenues dropped more than 7.5% when controlling for tax policy changes. And while the Great Recession was unusually severe, it still provides a useful benchmark for assessing how relatively well-prepared states were to ease some extent of their budget pressures as they entered the recession. So in the folder that was in your packet, you have a copy of our most recent report, which is called Managing Uncertainty. And in that report, we found that Minnesota's revenues are considerably more volatile than your economy, which compared to the other 49 states is relatively stable. And as noted in your Budget Trends Study Commission report from 2008, Minnesota's revenue volatility has been on the rise. And it's my understanding Matt Shepner with MMB will address those and other revenue trends in the second presentation today. But in any case, unforeseeable fluctuations in economic performance and revenue collections in Minnesota serve to further complicate the challenge of legislating and executing balanced budgets. Through our research, we've identified several steps states can take to better manage volatility while building savings for use in the next inevitable downturn. So today I'd like to give you an overview of our research on revenue volatility and our preliminary research on best practices for rainy day fund design. And from that research, I have three major findings I'd like to bring to you today. First, we recommend that policymakers regularly study volatility to understand the fluctuations unique to their state's economy and revenue structure. Second, we recommend that states use the results of this analysis to inform when, how, and how much they save during times of growth. And third, we recommend that state policymakers establish a clear purpose and explicit goals for their rainy day funds. So I'll use the remainder of this presentation to provide more context for each of these recommendations and show you a few examples of what other states are doing that reflect these emerging best practices. So as to a volatility study, it's an excellent practice to have an ongoing volatility study that informs the size of Minnesota's rainy day fund, which your MMB already performs. However, a more comprehensive volatility study that identifies the tax sources and drivers of volatility, much like the one performed as part of the Budget Trends Study Commission 5 years ago, can yield evidence-based recommendations for more than just the appropriate level of your reserves. It could, for example, inform deposit mechanisms that the when and how of savings that could be connected to trends in volatility. So you would accomplish two goals. You could manage volatility and also build savings at the times it makes the most sense to save, which is when there's money to save. So our research shows that ideally, a volatility study of a more comprehensive nature could be done every couple of years in order to identify emerging trends in revenue volatility rather than up or down ticks in revenue performance. And there are a couple other benefits of less frequent but more comprehensive studies. One is that they wouldn't require adjustments to fund policies be legislated every year. And it would still allow for periodic review of fund policy to make sure that your funds are meeting their stated purposes. So I'd like to offer you an example of a state we think does a particularly good job of this right now. And there aren't that many states we know of that are doing regular comprehensive volatility studies. But one state is, and that state is Utah. So in Utah, they've been doing a volatility study since 2008. And their study has three attributes which we think make it both unique and particularly effective. The first is that their study is statutorily required. And it's periodic. They do it every 3 years. And the third is that this study has directly informed budget reserve policy in Utah at least twice, in 2009 and 2012. And both times, the state acted on the recommendations of the study to increase the threshold for their two budget reserve funds in line with the volatility of the revenues that feed both of those funds. So in this session year, Utah legislators chose also to expand the scope of their study to consider options for deposit mechanisms that are tied to revenue volatility. They're also expanding their study to consider the state's options for managing uncertainty in federal funding streams as well. And even though Utah, like Minnesota, already does a volatility study, Utah has recognized the opportunity to better inform their fiscal policies through research by improving on this existing good practice. The second recommendation I'd like to talk a little bit about is deposit rules. As you all know, prioritizing savings during times of growth can lessen, though perhaps never eliminate, the need for the most difficult budget choices like tax increases or spending cuts in lean times. To that end, we recommend that states consider implementing rainy day fund deposit rules that are connected in some way to volatility. And over the last 6 months, we've been researching these mechanisms that states have in place for building up their rainy day fund balances, namely deposit rules. And we found, that while 38 states do not directly link their savings mechanisms to volatility, 12 states do. So here are the 38 states that our research finds don't directly link savings to managing volatility. A word on Minnesota. You're a little unique within this category because while you still use a determination of end of year surplus, or fiscal position as we usually call it, to make your deposits, you use your forecast to make that determination rather than a close of accounting measure. And we think it's a good idea to place determination of a deposit to a rainy day fund earlier in the budget process than later, as you currently do, since it makes savings in times of growth a higher budget priority. However, this mechanism in Minnesota and the other 37 states on this map does not work to directly hedge volatility, capturing and setting aside unusual growth in volatile revenue sources for later use. Now, these 12 states all have at least one deposit rule that is directly linked to volatility. Five of these states have rules that consider volatility in overall revenues. Four states have rules that consider volatility in specific revenue sources. And three of them have rules that consider economic volatility. So none of these states have a perfect deposit rule for their rainy day funds. However, all of them do exhibit a pattern of making savings a consistent and predictable pattern during times of growth. So why should these 38 states look to the 12 states in red to consider instituting a deposit rule? Well, primarily because rainy day funds are meant to relieve budget pressure, not contribute to it. A deposit rule connected to revenue volatility has the natural advantage of not rushing progress towards a fund target balance ahead of the pace of revenue growth. And we've run a few scenarios of what volatility-connected deposit rules could look like in Minnesota. And those scenarios are in your packet on the handout that looks like this. The scenarios we present here are based on current law rules in other states, with the details and thresholds adjusted in various ways. And it's only intended to illustrate these ideas, which can be hard to relate directly from place to place without a fair bit of data in hand. And I'd be happy to address any questions you may have about these scenarios during the Q&A or afterwards. So, without further ado, talk a little bit about Virginia. Because Virginia has an automatic deposit rule that we think is pretty interesting. In Virginia, they have a two-part deposit rule, a mandatory part and a discretionary part. And the mandatory part of their rule is tied to growth in the state's three largest tax sources, which for them are personal income taxes, sales taxes, and corporate income taxes. And in this chart, you can see it has worked well to ensure that saving is a consistent pattern in times of growth. So the mandatory part, the one that considers revenue growth, looks at both historic revenue growth over the past 6 years, as well as growth over the previous year, to set a threshold for what's probably one-time revenue growth. Revenues in excess of that threshold get automatically deposited into the state's revenue stabilization fund. The legislature can always save more than the rule requires if they choose by appropriation, but the mandatory rule ensures that savings is always a priority in years where there's money to save. So instituting a deposit rule in a state like Minnesota, it doesn't have to necessarily replace other existing mechanisms for how you save for your next downturn, but it could help mitigate volatility in the meantime. So the next state I'd like to tell you about is Texas. Texas has a deposit rule that's tied to volatility in its severance taxes on oil and gas production. But it also has several other mechanisms to grow its balance, including one that includes the state's fiscal position, similar to Minnesota, and another that provides for appropriation. And Texas sets aside 3/4 of the growth in its severance taxes over a benchmark year into the fund. This is because severance taxes are the state's single most volatile, significant revenue source. And in this chart, you see the four taxes that brought in 3/4 of the state's total revenues in 2012, ranked in the order of their volatility. And as you can see, severance taxes actually only accounted for 8% of their total state revenues in that year. But they're the most volatile, which is why it made sense for them to capitate that volatility through this rule. And there are other states that have more than one deposit mechanism in place for their rainy day funds, like Louisiana. They also have a deposit rule tied to swings in severance tax revenue, but they deposit 25% of all non-recurring designated money in their revenue forecast. And they deposit all money available to the general fund and dedicated funds in excess of their state's expenditure limit. And the other example I'd like to tell you about is Massachusetts, which actually has 4 deposit mechanisms for their budget stabilization fund, including a deposit rule tied to volatility in the state's freestanding tax on capital gains. This deposit rule works well from an administrative standpoint in Massachusetts because they tax capital gains income separate from other types of personal income. They also deposit, though, half of 1% of tax revenue from the preceding year. They deposit amounts left in budgeted funds at the end of their fiscal year, and legal judgment and settlement income in excess of $10 million, one-time revenues along those lines. And the last example I'd like to tell you about, is deposit rules that are tied to economic volatility, like in Arizona, Indiana, and Michigan. And these work relatively well in Arizona, where the state's economy is relatively volatile and its tax revenues track closely with economic performance. But we don't think this kind of thing would work as well in Minnesota because your revenues are significantly more volatile than your economy. Deposits under this kind of rule would probably take a very long time, potentially too long, to reach the target recommended by MMB. And for this reason, we don't think it would be an ideal policy for your state. And the third recommendation, final recommendation for today, is about setting a clear purpose and goals for your reserve funds. We have upcoming research on the rules states have created to govern withdrawals from their rainy day funds. And what is clear from our early work on this topic is that states stand to benefit greatly from setting a clear purpose and goals for their rainy day funds. Without a clear purpose, gauging fund performance is nearly impossible. You need to know whether what your fund is intended to do in order to gauge whether it is successful or not. Fund balances alone, withdrawals, transfers from your fund, don't usually tell a very clear story about performance. So clarifying the purpose of a fund will help guide how much you should attempt to save, for example. And your MMB provides this annual report, which estimates what you would need in reserves to cover the revenue drop-off resulting from a more typical recession than the Great Recession. And analytically, we think their approach is very good because it looks at the chance of that kind of recession happening in Minnesota and assumes a level of acceptable budget risk associated with that possibility. Until revenue forecasters come up with a way to know the future with certainty, the approach MMB is using is at least as good as anything else we've seen in other states, and possibly better. But to the purpose, once the purpose or purposes for your fund are set, goals can cascade from that. Goals are statements about what you're trying to accomplish with your policy. So in brief, the purpose of your fund should ideally be set in statute. It should be used to directly inform the design of rainy day fund policies. And it should be revisited or reconsidered periodically to make sure the fund is performing as desired. And we will have more to offer you on this topic and the state of current practice on this front, as well as emerging best practices in months to come. So this is the end of my presentation. I hope it's been informative to the current conversation you've been having in Minnesota. And just to recap those recommendations, we recommend that you regularly study volatility. We recommend that you take that study to inform when, how, and how much you save, and that you establish that clear purpose and goals for your fund. Thank you again for this opportunity to present. We'll be happy to take any questions after Matt.
Great. Well, thank you for being here. We're going to ask you a few questions first. Okay. And then we're gonna hear from Mr. Shepner with MMB, because I know people are hearing in that presentation that our revenues are more volatile than our economy, which is good for this committee to remember. And we'll want to talk about that a little bit in a minute. But first, we'll go to a few questions, and then we'll get hear the next presentation, and hopefully have more questions after that. So Representative Earhart, then Carlson, and then Loeffler. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have to admit I'm the only one in the room that doesn't know about the Pew Trust. I would listen more intensely if I could understand where they're coming from, what they are. Are they economists? Are they a secret society coming out of South Georgia? Or what are they?
Well,
they never said anything.
I think they did at the beginning, and you weren't in the room. So if you want to remind people who the Pew Charitable Trusts are again,
sure.
And there's a folder in your packet, Representative Earhart, too, for you to refer to.
Right.
Please.
I'm sorry to be repetitive for those of you who heard this before. So the Pew Charitable Trust is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. We are driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems, and we apply a rigorous analytical approach to inform public policy, improve public policy, inform the public, and stimulate civic life.
I heard you say that, but how are you funded? Or are you funded by the Koch brothers? Or
Okay.
No, sir.
So Ms. Earhart. Okay, so now we're getting to the question. I think
sure.
That's important because often we hear from, liberal or conservative groups, and we don't really know that. And I think you're different than that. So if you want to tell us about that, please.
Okay, I'll give you the history in brief. We are currently a 501c3 organization. That was a shift that Pew made from being a foundation in the mid-late 2000s. Mm-hmm. The money that underlies the organization is actually in the form of 7 charitable trusts established by 4 heirs of the Sun Oil Company back in the 1940s.
And that's the Pew family, to clarify.
Yes.
It's a family name.
It is a family name.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for that. I didn't know that either, so thank you. Okay. Representative Carlson.
Yeah. Money can be used for Chair, I, like you, was able to attend the meeting in Chicago, and I don't remember if I asked this question. If I did, I don't remember the answer. But when you're calculating reserves, do you take into account the reserves that are held by some of our state entities, University of Minnesota, the Minscu system, which is our other higher ed system, local units of government, counties, cities, school districts? That might give you a slightly different snapshot, if you do, of what the fiscal health of a state is relative to reserves.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Furr, yes, please. Or Ms. Murphy, whoever.
To clarify, I think you're, when we spoke about this briefly before the hearing, I think your question stems partly from a presentation made by one of our Pew colleagues about one of the reserve measures that we also sometimes refer to at Pew that looks at total general fund year-end balance and total reserve holdings. Mm-hmm. We get that data from what the state reports to NASBO. So whatever gets reported into that number is what's reflected in that measure. Our project is looking specifically at what at rainy day funds that states use to smooth volatility in their budgets. Mm-hmm. So in our research, we've been looking at your budget reserve fund, and because in Minnesota you also talk about this fund in relation to your cash flow account simultaneously, we've been looking at those balances together, given the context of these conversations and recent legislation. But that's kind of a separate measure from the one that we were discussing in Chicago.
Okay, Representative Carlson, please.
Madam Chair, the reason I raised that question, when I've dealt with the University of Minnesota, for example, they often talk about their reserve for two purposes. One's to have it available for targets of opportunity to do matching and so on for federal funds for research or whatever. But also they talk at times about the state's volatility, mm-hmm. and that they feel they need to maintain, I think it's generally perceived at about 5 or 6% reserve to kind of give them a cushion against the state's volatility if we were to have to reduce the expenditures for the appropriations to the University of Minnesota. And I suspect if we had a school board represented here, they might say somewhat the same thing. Mm-hmm. And so they do use volatility, the risk mm-hmm. of it, as one of their reasons for a mm-hmm. a reserve. And they also have it for cash flow and many of the same reasons that the mm-hmm. state of Minnesota would.
Thank you.
I would say that the kind of methodology that MMB currently uses to go ahead and set a risk tolerance threshold is perfectly applicable to the University of Minnesota system or any other system. I mean, and I'm sure Matt would speak more about that, but in general, we think that's a good approach.
Great. Thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Ms. Erford, thank you so much for being here. And I had a couple of questions. One was it's sort of related, but a little bit different, and that is to Representative Carlson's, and that is we have a lot of special funds, and we don't typically have a reserve policy for them. They tend to be dedicated revenue funds for various purposes. And, you know, it seems like most of your presentation and the discussion has been about the general fund. But have you looked at those special purpose funds as well?
Sarah Ford.
We have not. Partly because every state has many, many, many of those funds, and the data on them tends to be rather difficult to get in a 50-state context. We do, in our group, primarily 50-state research. When we identify states that have particularly promising or interesting policies, we dig deeper into that. But no, into the short answer to your question is no, we have not.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you very much. And the other question was, it's been quite a long time, but when we have had reserves, and then you start sliding into a recession, the question is always, well, it's a rainy day fund, but is it raining enough? And, you know, are there good examples of policies that say when you ought to start tapping into those reserves to provide for stability and services? And is that some of the kind of policy goals that you're hinting at as part of your next study?
Yeah, the purpose and goals, that conversation that has to happen in a legislative arena, setting that clarity in place is kind of the logical first step to going into the withdrawal rule arena, which you mentioned. to your question about triggers, when is it raining? When is our economy really heading into a recession? There are states that have those mechanisms in place. Virginia is one of them, but there are others. And I mentioned we are doing research on that topic, and it is unfortunately in early enough stages that I don't have more detail on it for you ready today. But in short, yeah, states are perfectly able to create rules that look to economic performance along any number of measures. Unemployment is one that gets looked at frequently for obvious reasons, and can go ahead and set standards for when, that have to be met in order to allow withdrawals from the fund for stated purposes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Airford. Why is it, do you think, in your analysis of our state's economy and versus our tax revenues, that our system is so much more volatile than our economy?
Ms. Airford.
I do not have a short or clear-cut answer for you on that. I would actually think that probably, because we go 50 state in the scope of our research, we are not able to dig in as far into the drivers of your revenue volatility as probably your own state agencies or state think tanks probably can and have. Sometimes we know, for example, states that have severance tax revenue tend to be much more revenue volatile than they are economically volatile because of that type of economic activity in that tax base. In Minnesota, it's not as clear-cut to us, so I guess I would probably ask that we ask Matt with MMB about that one.
And we will ask him. We have, and you feel free to continue after Representative Loon, then we'll have Runbeck, Anderson, and Draskowski, and then we'll hear from MMB, and hopefully they'll give us more information on that too. So Representative Loon, further.
Well, and thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Airford, and I think that probably is a good question for our own department, but just wondering if, because you have looked at all 50 states and we tend to look more at what we're doing here, I mean, are there any patterns you're seeing or similarity to some of the other states that have implemented, additional policies where whether a percentage of their revenues above the average are going into reserve? Are they as reliant on heavily weighted towards income taxes and corporate income taxes as we are, or what have you identified in terms of things that are similar or different to those states?
Ms. Harper, please.
Thank you. In general, in our study, we found that the majority of states are more revenue volatile than they are economically volatile. To some extent, that has to do with the measure of economic performance that we use in our study, which is something called the State Coincident Index. It's an index developed by the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia, and it's predicated on four labor market variables. So the reason I tell you that information is because, for example, states that have a lot of agricultural employment don't actually show up in that index as being as economically volatile as they might be. There are some shortcomings of that measurement that are just built into it. In terms of what that means for state policy, though, the fact that most states, not all, as we measure them, are more revenue volatile than economically volatile, it means that There's just opportunity for each state. There's a challenge from volatility in each state, regardless of how volatile revenues are. If your state's extremely revenue volatile, like Wyoming, we would say you have an opportunity to have a deposit rule that can really try and help smooth things and create these reserves to help you have a more stable state budget perspective. But in a state like Minnesota, you're actually not, you're about middle of the pack in our study on revenue volatility, but it's still a problem for you as you work to create your budget. The relativity of that volatility to other states is interesting, perhaps, but it does not speak directly to what your challenges may be.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you. And so, Madam Chair, and I'll just finish up because I know some of these questions are probably better for MMB, but from your studies, the more volatile of the taxes that we collect is corporate tax. I mean, is that something that's indicative across all states? If you have a higher corporate tax rate, that is a contributor to volatility in your revenue stream?
Ms. Harper.
That was actually not a variable in our study. We did not look at the interaction between rates, collections, and volatility.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Thank you. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Erfurt, I do appreciate the fact that somebody is taking a look at this aspect of budgeting and so on and so forth, and that different states have different tax structures and different revenue and economies. To me, the volatility is no mystery. In fact, I mean, we have a Minnesota Center for Fiscal Excellence, which has told us for the last at least 4 years that I've been here that we have a uniquely volatile tax system because we rely on the income tax, and we rely very heavily on the progressivity of that tax. We are the second most progressively taxed state in the nation. So it's interesting to me that, I mean, to me that's the problem, and you're not focusing on the problem. And we seem to be more interested in how we are going to, continue our current tax policy and then find ways to protect against that. Do you have any, progressivity in general as an income tax method? Very difficult to sustain sort of equanimity?
Ms. Hereford.
We actually do not look into kind of the granular aspects of personal incomes or income tax or any particular tax structure specific to the state. Like I mentioned, we didn't look at rates and interaction of rates with collections in this particular study. It's a little bit beyond the scope of this research. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Anderson, and then Drazkowski, and then we'll go to MMB. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and forgive me if I missed this part, but can you tell me, when you're making the recommendations on what the budget reserve should be, in what cases are you advising states that they can use that money, and when is your rainy day, essentially, and what qualifies for a rainy day expense?
We are actually not advocating any particular threshold level for any given state. What we are recommending is that states use some sort of evidence-based process and consider volatility in order to set that threshold at the appropriate level given the volatility of your revenues and or your economy. And as for the withdrawal rules, as I mentioned, we have research underway for that. We do not have it far enough along for me to be able to share any preliminary results legitimately because we don't have them yet. But as soon as we do, we'd like to be happy to speak more about that.
Representative Anderson, further? No. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Erfurt. I was looking at page 8 on your handout and looking at the different volatility levels between states, kind of interesting, curious. So maybe inherent in what you had to say is that if your volatility is lower, you don't have to retain as much of the people's money in these rainy day accounts. Is that part of your message and what I kind of gathered? Is that accurate?
Ms. Erfurt.
We say that the level of your budget reserve should be in some way commensurate with the level of volatility in your revenues. Now, the exact methodology and approach used to determine that level may and perhaps should vary by state.
So, Representative Drazkowski.
So, Madam Chair and Ms. Erfurt, so if, I'm looking at our sheet from MMB here, and if, we've got a large share of our taxes that are income tax based. So if we reduced reliance on the income tax and relied more on a low volatility tax like the sales tax, we wouldn't have as much volatility and wouldn't have to, in that case, probably hold back as much money in these reserves.
Please, Ms. Erfurt.
We are not actually advocating any kind of tax change in our study. We went ahead and made the assumption that addressing volatility through adjustments to the tax code in any state that's not our assumption in this study. Our assumption is that your taxes go ahead and exist as they currently exist on the books. So this is an observed volatility study, and the chart that you point up is actually not controlling for any kind of tax policy change. This is just census reported revenues, measured volatility in a relatively simple statistical measure, interquartile range. So, the only thing that we can really say from this study is that you can capitate volatility in a number of ways. You can try to do so through adjustments to the tax code, which, as you all know, come at trade-offs against various competing, often competing priorities with your tax codes, and that's a legislative decision that you obviously can discuss. But the way to kind of manage volatility without going into that arena is to be pragmatic about reserve funds and set them at appropriate levels, given that level of budgetary risk associated with revenue fluctuation.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we're going to ask Mr. Scheppner to join us. And just as we, you know, have him come up, and we'll have more questions for Pew as well. I found it interesting in looking at the Pew study, if you look at pages 5 and 6, amazingly how Illinois is just right with the national trends. Just, it's just amazing to look at how different states are. Alaska, very different. And then North Carolina couldn't be any closer tracking with their own economic performance. I mean, it's almost like two lines right on top of each other. And then Wyoming being more volatile than Minnesota. I just think those four charts are just very interesting to think about. And I think the questions people have raised on both sides of the aisle here really do highlight you could change your taxes by having less volatile ones. You could change your deposit rules. You could, you know, change your reserve. I mean, there's just a lot going on here. But looking at North Carolina, that one just really blows my mind that their tax collections are right with their economic performance. It makes me think their revenues must be completely designed around the economy. I don't have any insight into that at all, but I think looking at some of these pages are really interesting for members to see and think about, and we appreciate the information.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And welcome to the committee, Mr. Scheppner. We're going to, you know, not everybody knows you yet. So you're an economist with MMB. If you want to just let us know a little bit more who you are, because not all of you have met you yet. So yep. Welcome.
Hello,
to the committee.
Madam Chair, members. My name is Matt Scheppner. I am an economist with Minnesota Management and Budget. I've been working there with my colleague John Pelequin under Tom Stinson since 2008 until this past summer. And as you know, he retired. And now we have the great fortune of working with new state economist Laura Kalambakidis.
Great.
I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak on this very important topic, and thank you, Mary and Brenna, for presenting your research as well. Very, very good stuff. In 2008, as part of analysis prepared for the State Budget Trends Study Commission, former state economist Tom Stinson and I examined the volatility of Minnesota's tax base. This study attempts to answer detailed questions concerning the measurement, comparisons, and causes of instability in Minnesota's revenue system over time, and the implications this evolution has on the state's risk management strategies. Since that time, we've continued to refine our method to better reflect the evolving nature of uncertainty. We've also updated the analysis to take into account more recent data, including the Great Recession and its immediate aftermath, which had a severe effect on state tax revenues and generated historically difficult budgeting conditions. Nonetheless, our principal conclusions remain largely the same as in 2008. First, Minnesota's general fund tax base has grown increasingly more volatile since the late 1990s, a trend that has continued still over the past 5 years. Our study attributes this recent increase in volatility to the combination of both shifting consumption patterns towards the largely untaxed services sector, as well as strong growth in performance-based compensation and other forms of investment income. Second, and I'm going to turn your attention to my handout, which is just a one page with two tables on it. Some tax sources are far more volatile than others. Minnesota's corporate franchise tax base, for example, which comprises only about 7% of Minnesota's general fund tax revenue, is the most volatile of the four major revenue sources. In fact, we estimate, and you can see from the top table in table one, we estimate that the corporate income tax is about 5 times more volatile than the state's general sales tax base, which along with the property tax base is one of Minnesota's most inherently stable sources of revenue. And while still relatively low compared to the corporate income tax base, the individual income tax, which makes up about half of our general fund revenues, is the second most volatile of Minnesota's four major revenues. The primary source of the individual income tax volatility is indeed capital gains, which we find to be one of the most volatile components of the total tax system overall. This is largely because capital realizations depend on factors such as investor decisions and the underlying accrual of gains within assets. I'll also note that the most stable component of the individual income tax base, which is wages and salaries, has been increasingly volatile since the late 1990s. We think attributable to a growing trend towards stock options and bonuses payments. Third, and hopefully this will answer some or at least allude to some of the questions that were asked. Third, it's true that replacing highly volatile tax-based components with less volatile sources could reduce the volatility of the overall general fund tax system. However, such changes would also affect revenue growth rates and the distribution of the tax burden among taxpayers. For example, it would be safe to say that reducing the state's reliance on highly volatile revenue sources such as capital gains and corporate franchise tax receipts for less volatile revenue sources for such things as clothing or consumer services or non-prescription drugs could reduce the volatility of the overall general fund tax system. But this reduction would come at the expense of higher expected growth rates that are attributable or we've found to be consistent with the corporate income tax and the capital gains tax, and as well as the overall progressivity of the state tax system. This is why careful analysis is required to understand the full impact of an introduction or removal of a specific revenue source into or out of the tax system. Finally, our revenue volatility research also provides an empirical basis for estimating an appropriate size of the state's budget reserve. As with insurance, the right level of budget reserves depends on your willingness to accept risks and costs. That said, if I can turn your attention to Table 2 of the handout, our analysis finds that given existing levels of revenue volatility, a reserve policy of about 4.9% of general fund revenues or spending would be sufficient to cover a deficit in all but one out of every 20 periods. In statistics, that's roughly about a 95% confidence interval. That would imply about a $1.9 billion reserve for the current 2014-15 biennium. By comparison, the state's current budget reserve account of $811 million, and that's updated to include the amount established from House File 1777 last week, totals about 2.1% of general fund revenues, and if the cash flow is included, total reserves equal about 3% of revenues. Nonetheless, that still places Minnesota's current reserve balances well below levels believed to be consistent with underlying volatility and what rating agencies believe to be consistent with sound financial practice. State bond ratings depend on a number of factors, including economy, fiscal management, government framework, and budgetary performance. But both Standard & Poor's and Moody's specifically include a measure of adequacy of statutory budget reserves in their credit analysis. In S&P's analytical framework, for example, top scores are assigned to states with statutory reserve levels of about 4% or more of biennial general fund revenue. Moody's rating guidelines indicate that AAA-rated states should have statutory reserves of at least 5% of biennial revenues, and this is outlined within the table along with what the comparable dollar levels would be. So, Madam Chair, that concludes my prepared remarks, and I'd be happy to answer questions you may have.
Great, thank you. I have a question, if I may. Just and just thinking about the second part of the sheet you have here on the Minnesota rainy day. So if we went in the tax bill that was just signed into law from when you add in the cash flow, if we're now at 3% and the MMB recommendation is 4.9, what were we before the bill passed? What percent were we at?
It's a good question. So if you're interested, you can just pencil in. You'd change the 811 to 661, and then the number underneath that would change to a little over $1 billion, so $1.011 billion.
Okay.
And then the percentages on just the budget reserve account alone was 1.7%.
Okay.
And prior to the 1777, we were at about 2.6% of you include the cash flow.
Okay, thank you. And then further down there, when you were just saying, you know, Standard & Poor's says you need to be at 4, and Moody's is at 5, and given Minnesota's volatility, MMB is saying 4.9. You know, I'm just trying to think back. You know, when I was first here, I think we did have a AAA from the rating agencies, and I don't think we were ever at 4 or 5. Did we have a higher reserve that we had that AAA, or have the rating agencies changed how you get a AAA and how you keep a AAA. And I know we got downgraded at the time as we were, and Representative Carlson might remember some of this too, as, you know, reserves were being used up to deal with, and I'm not talking about the last deficit, the Great Recession, I'm talking before that. We had already been downgraded as we were avoiding both spending cuts and revenue increases, which is always the case around here. Both parties don't like either one. What were we at that we had a AAA? Do you know?
Well, our up until Friday, our statutory budget reserve cap had not changed since, I believe, 2001. And I believe, so that would have been just over $1 billion if you include the cash flow account since 2001. And that was set as a dollar level. And so the value of that has eroded over time with inflation. And we've gone back and looked at it, and I think relative to revenues within that biennium, we were just over 4% of, and that just because we had set a dollar level in statute, that just eroded it over time down to the 2.6%.
Okay. Thank you. Rep. Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Was there any scientific basis upon which you let the Senate do what they did? Or did they just put their finger in the wind and say, we'll do this much and so forth? Did it follow any of your principles that you're talking about?
Well, Representative Earhart, you know, Mr. Shepner didn't write that bill, but would you like to?
Is there any scientific basis based on, or any mathematical or any kind of sense at all?
So and maybe we should back up the methodology that, you know, was done, as Ms. Manzi talked about, what changed in the bill is not only was $150 million brought into the reserves, just brought in, but there's a mechanism that says one of the two forecasts every year will carve off, I think it's a third, of the number beyond the cash flow in the reserve and keep putting it into a pot until we hit, I believe it's $2 billion. I mean, you can correct me. And that reaches what percent? I mean, do we hit the MMB recommendation of 4.9 then? I mean, maybe just refresh us on what was in that bill that just, you know, became law. What is the mechanism there for not the current 150 that's getting added, but the ongoing, that if the surpluses continue, what will happen with those surpluses?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Earhart. It is a little complex in the sense that there are three pieces, and that is, what is your current level, what is your aspirational level, and what is the mechanism that's going to get you to the aspirational level. And so what I believe the Senate did in House File 1776, they set that mechanism in place, that prior to that there was no well, for one, the reserve target or this aspirational target was not set on anything other than a dollar level that was set back in 2001. Otherwise, beyond that, the mechanism that they've now put in place, Madam Chair said, carves out a third of November forecast balances that will now attempt to fund this, the budget reserve, up into a target now that is based on the same 4.9% you see in the table, which is data-related, data-specific, so it's research-based. And so I would say if you're looking for a place that the Senate did use a research-based mechanism, it's allowing the calculation of this aspirational reserve level to be determined by our budget reserve report.
Okay. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Commissioner of Revenue has at times in the past spoken about enhancing the reserve. And has what happened here followed whatever guidelines he's talked about behind the scenes or wherever he's talked about? I've seen him quoted in the paper as increasing the reserves. And
Sir Shepner.
I don't want to speak for Commissioner Showalter. However, if Madam Chair would like to answer that question on the governor's position, the governor's supplemental budget, or I could invite the budget director, Margaret Kelly, down.
Well, Madam Chair, I didn't even know the governor was involved in this. I've just heard Bach and the Commissioner of Revenue speak in the newspaper on several occasions, being quoted that we ought to increase our budget reserve. So I thought maybe floating around in the background, there's been some suggestions.
Well, I think there's been suggestions from the House, Senate, and the governor's office. You know, I certainly was trying to provide language that I thought would be helpful for the Senate deliberating, and I know the sent it to the governor's office as well. The governor, and you know, if you want to ask Ms. Kelly, she's here. The governor did propose, I believe, $440 million in reserves or $450, so clearly he wanted a higher number, but I don't believe he proposed a mechanism through a forecasting where there's an excess that starts getting you to a place where you're going to hit, you know, the shooting for the good rating. So I don't think he proposed that. The Senate started with, let's put it all in reserves. Remember that? You know, that was the beginning. And then the House was sort of tax cuts, and then the governor was some of both. And, you know, I think the way I read the result of that is it was sort of a grand compromise, at least, you know, from the majority party standpoint, maybe not the minority, but that, you know, at one body sort of looking at more tax cuts, one looking at more reserves, and the governor looking at both. And so I do think it was a good mix of that. You know, one of the questions I have going forward now is, you know, that's current law, and if it doesn't change, you know, so fast forward 10 years, let's say, and the surpluses stop, and the carving off a third has stopped, and we've hit this number, so there's no need to replenish any reserves because they're full. You know, how do legislators, and this is just both parties, just someday, you know, how do they think about using these reserves in tough times again? Because my experience has been both the Democrats and the Republicans have used the reserves in tough times, and for good reasons. I mean, people want to avoid spending cuts because they hurt people. And people want to avoid raising taxes because they hurt people too. They're bad options. People don't like raising taxes. They don't like cutting programs. They don't like cutting schools. So people will just naturally avoid them if they can, and they'll go to the reserves. So, you know, I think that's a question mark in my mind down the road, is when that next big thing happens, you know, how will legislators, no matter who's in charge, and how will governors, no matter which party they're from, you know, address this, and will they be accused of raiding the reserves? You know, and I just think it's a discussion we're all just going to have to think about if the law stands for 10 years or 20 years or 30 years or whatever. You know, it's just sort of an open question, I think. But most people, I think, have felt that the reserve number, and I've heard this on both sides of the aisle in the time I've been here, most people think the reserves needed to be increased. And if you look at the numbers, if we were at 1.7% before, and to get a AAA, you have to be at 4 or 5, I think it's pretty obvious to people that you need to get the reserves up again, and that's what the Senate was working on. So, Representative Carlson and then Barrett.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I was going back initially, but I do have a question of the testifier. Your comment when you looked at North Carolina, I happened to visit, I'm a native Minnesotan, but my wife is from North Carolina, and so when she had family that was still alive, we would visit there quite a bit. And one of the things that you notice upon your arrival is that the sales tax is on just about everything, not everything, but heavy reliance on the sales tax. I think that might drive the closeness of their economy relative to their revenue. However, the other thing you notice is that it's a very regressive tax. You know, so Minnesota has tried to blend some progressivity into our sales tax system, and that's probably why we're a little more volatile in that regard than they may be. But my question was, you probably heard my question of the testifiers from Pew, Mr. Schubner, and where do those local reserves and reserves like the higher education institutions fit into the way MMB looks at the fiscal stability and the volatility of the state? Because we look at that when we're going through, especially when we're going through difficult budgetary times, and what we might have to do to make adjustments. We're usually very aware of, you know, the example I used, the U of M or local units of government, and what they may or may not be able to absorb if we have to reduce appropriations.
Yeah, I would agree that, Madam Chair, Representative
please.
Carlson, I would agree that not including state and local taxes in the analysis does perhaps distort the property tax. Our original intent during the Budget Trend Study Commission was to look solely at the general fund, which we continue to do today. Now, if you look back at Table 1 of my handout, the property tax is perhaps one of the most stable revenue sources, and that's where the local governments rely most heavily. So it's certainly the would be relevant to study the local government in terms of its interaction with the state. We haven't done that necessarily, but it would be interesting to just to keep in mind that they don't the local governments don't necessarily deal with the level of risk and uncertainty that the state does.
And Madam Chair, and of course, I was using too the University of Minnesota as an example, which would not involve a property tax; it would involve tuition. But there's a certain volatility, if you will, with what happens on the tuition or cost of attendance side when we're dealing with appropriations as well.
Yeah.
Just a comment.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, part of the reason the property tax base is so stable is because it's based on a levy of a price deflator for state and local government purchases, and you can make a comparable argument for the university, too.
Thank you. Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a couple quick questions regarding Table 1 here. And I'm wondering, regarding the growth rates in each of the areas of tax that we have here, are they at all tied in or directly related to the revenue portion of the budget, projected budget surplus or deficit, or are these totally unrelated to that calculation?
This is largely unrelated to that. So this is tax-based, so this is what we're taxing. Then you can convert it into tax revenues using various rates and things for each of these bases. But this largely just looks at the tax base. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you're saying there are other calculations that determine what we think we'll get in revenue over the next two-year period.
Absolutely.
Okay.
A lot more modeling, other potential for error, added error. But that, I should say with that, we do try and capture those elasticities within our budget reserve number. So the budget reserve number attempts to look at tax revenue. This chart, this table here, is largely just tax-based.
Okay. Thank you. And then one
yes,
other
please.
Question, Madam Chair. So in the, more of a curiosity than anything, but I'm looking at the individual growth rates and determining why they vary as they do. So you look at individual income tax base, and that's 3.4, which tends to be similar to the property tax base, obviously two different measures. But, you know, you could argue a lot of things are in the income tax, the number of people in our state, the amount of income they have, different tax rates, whether the tax rate has gone up or declined. But it's similar to property tax. Then you got corporate franchise tax, which the growth rate is expected to be much higher. But the one I'm curious about is the general sales tax base, which is lower than any of those. I would think if individuals and businesses have more money, have more income, then they would be spending a lot of that, and therefore the general sales tax base would be higher than the 2.1%, which in my mind is a lot lower than the 3.4. Again, kind of a nitpicky question, but I'm just curious why that's significantly lower than income.
Mr. Shepner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Barrett. I would say that just general consumption over time grows slower than income. And as you can see, there is a correlation here between the more volatile components and their growth rate, meaning that the more volatile it is, it's likely that the growth rate is higher. So that gets to the discussion about when you remove certain things or target specific things, there's a give and take there with the growth rate. I could look at that a little more and maybe get back to you. I don't have a real definitive answer, I guess.
Sure. Thank you. Not that big a deal. I just was curious and wondered. I would have thought they would be similar. If you'd like to, that'd be great. Appreciate the information.
Thank you. And, you know, I wonder, too, if you had mentioned at the beginning on Representative Barrett's question, at the beginning of your presentation, you mentioned, you know, as we move to a service industry, you know, I wonder if that sales tax, which does look so flat, if it's because we don't, especially now that we've repealed those three B2Bs, you know, we're not taxing really the service part of the sales tax. So maybe that's part of it. But
I have a question on the individual income tax piece. You know, you mentioned that the capital gains, stock options, and bonuses, you know, are in that number. Mm-hmm. And those are very volatile. And that you know, that people get that. I mean, if you don't get a, you know, people aren't really given bonuses during the recession, but in times of growth and you know, capital gains start pouring in when the economy is doing well. What percentage of that individual income tax base number you have there that gives you a tax base volatility of 4.7, do you think most of the volatility is applied because of things like stock options and bonuses and capital gains, or is it just, hey, the economy is getting better, so more people are working and more people are getting paid more? You know, could you comment on the makeup of that individual income tax volatility?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. That's an important point, because the wages and salaries component of individual income tax base makes up about three-quarters of income there, whereas the capital gains is less than 10%, can fluctuate between 5 and 8 or 9% of gross income. With that, the performance-based issue that we as economists who attempt to try to forecast this is that bonuses and options are not easily broken out from the data within wages and salaries. So this is just an inference that we've made based on the increasing volatility of the wages and salaries component, or that three-quarters of income within this space. But we do have a measure that we think is adequately tries to remove some of this over time. It's not perfect, but it is something that we look at. And I guess that's, yeah, hopefully that answers your question.
Great, thank you. Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if this is for Mr. Shepner or maybe people generally, but we're looking at the, as I look at Table 2 here and I look at the amount of money both in our current budget reserves and kind of the aspirational budget reserve or whatever that word was, you know, I wonder, I asked a question of the Met Council this morning, and they say they've got $700 million in current short-term, medium-term, and long-term investments. And I'm wondering, is there a reason we don't include those in our budget reserve number? Close to three-quarters of $1 billion that the Metropolitan Council is investing.
Well, my guess is that's only levied on the people of 7 of the 87 counties. So it's not really a state resource. Unless you live in those 7 counties, you don't pay that. The other 80 counties don't live in it. But, I mean, Mr. Shepner, maybe you want to add that.
I'm guessing, Madam Chair, I'm guessing it's out of the purview of the general fund. So, So it's not something that we've looked at specifically. I don't know necessarily regarding the policy of using it either.
I don't know if anybody else wants to comment, if nonpartisan staff or anyone else. I honestly don't know that, because I don't know how, you know, Ms. Kelly's here. I don't know what MMB adds in and not as far as
There should be a bill, Madam Chair.
Well, I have to tell you, Representative Draskowski, as somebody who pays that tax, I would fight you on that, because my residents have to pay for that, and we don't want to be the reserve for the whole state. Because that's a property tax burden we all carry, and the folks who are fortunate to live in the other 80 counties don't. Well, so I think, Chair, we would have a little argument about that.
Why are they keeping $700 million of your money?
Well, I mean, I think that is between the people who live in the metro who are paying that tax and the
$700 million of your money.
Well, I mean, I think that is between the people who live in the metro who are paying that tax and the Met Council, and how those monies get used and what their debt capacity should be and how much they're carrying in reserves. But, you know, again, for the rest of the state, they're really not involved in that equation. So you can see that's how that would play out. We, you know, we're being taxed for that, and no one else is. So, Ms. Kelly, did you want to comment on, you know, whether it's the Met Council reserves or any other local, you know, representative? Carlson also made comments about, you know, the different local units of government. And we, you know, we have looked at them. I mean, I remember Governor Plenty and the Democrats combined to use the school districts that we all found. There were certain school districts we could delay the payment in. You know, and we've all, both parties, gone through all these convolutions And in my mind, that's why the new reserve language is good, is because it avoids worse decisions. I mean, we've all gone through this, whether you pick through the old school shift or we looked at those 103 school districts who we could delay the timing. And, you know, both parties have done these, whether it's tobacco bonds or, you know. So to me, I think reserves help everybody from all political philosophies avoid worse decisions. But maybe you can comment on how do we talk about Met Council reserves or the Minsky reserves or the U of M reserves when we look at our state budget.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Margaret Kelly, State Budget Director, and I think it's a great conversation you're having here. We do have authority in law to manage payments between the state and Minsky and the state and the University of Minnesota. For cash flow purposes, not necessarily for reserves to dip into them for that, but if we have cash flow problems, we can delay payments to resolve those issues. We have looked to the general fund only in terms of managing our reserves. So what is general fund revenues? What is general fund spending? School district budgets are outside of that. Met Council budget is outside of that. Local units of government budgets are outside of that. But I think that those budgets are looked at when spending decisions are made. So,
you represent Draskowski further? Or?
No, I'll have to get the bill ready, Madam Chair, for next time.
Okay, Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment on an earlier question right at the very beginning with the folks who were speaking with us from the Pew Charitable Trust. Just wanted to say that regardless of where funding for these various charitable funds come from, doesn't necessarily mean that they are then skewing their research. I mean, we have Rockefeller Foundation, Ford Foundation. If you look at the history of how those families accumulate their wealth, one can have a lot of debate about that. But doesn't necessarily mean that the trust themselves then are skewing, you know, their research or whatever. And to me, the Pew Charitable Trust is stellar, I think, in its research. So I just want to give you that comment. But, you know, I want to ask about, you know, this issue of reserves versus progressivity. There's a value in having a progressive tax system, and maybe one of the costs of that is volatility. I'm just wondering, you know, whether or not that really is such a bad thing. It does lead maybe to states having to have larger reserves, but some of us think that a just tax system is based on the ability to pay. I just want to make that question. I'm just wondering, though, with these increases in the reserve account, I'd just like to ask our speaker here today whether or not we are moving, or what would we need to move towards in order to reestablish our AAA bond rating. This was an issue that bothered me a lot when it happened, and I just felt that was very, very poor public policy. And I, you know, I'm not pointing a finger at any particular party or individuals, but at what is the process we would need, and how long do we need to go in order to restore our AAA bond rating, and how much has it cost our state and our borrowing authority over the last few years? I'm curious about those two.
Mr. Shepner, or Ms. Kelly, if you want to get involved in that one too.
Yeah, I think I might invite her.
Please. And the, you know, if the forecasting mechanism of a third of the forecast goes until you hit 4.9, does that alone get us to, will that just make us a AAA, or do we need to do even more than that?
Madam Chair, members, rating agencies are relatively quick to downgrade and very slow to upgrade. So while improving our reserves is very good in our favor in terms of are being upgraded for the rating agencies, we can't guarantee that an upgrade would happen. There are many things that they take into consideration. The state economy, the local economy, regional economies, reserves, debt guidelines, the whole shebang. And so whether or not this will result in an upgrade is not something we can guarantee or speak to, but it certainly would set us on the path.
Madam Chair.
Yes, please.
And then the other half of the question, do you have any estimates or as to how much it's cost our state in interest payments after we had lost our AAA bond rating?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't know if we've done that analysis. I think the difference in terms of interest rates between a AAA and a AA state is driven in part by the economy. To some extent, Minnesota does rest on its laurels, the fact that we have been a AAA state, and in many bond purchasers' eyes, we still are a AAA state, and they may be willing to pay a rate a little bit higher than a AA state. But we can do some analysis, if you want, on how interest rates have varied for AA versus AAA states and how we compare, but we haven't done that yet.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, just a comment to me. I try to run my own personal finances conservatively, which means I don't like the idea of carrying a lot of debt, and I like paying my bills on time to keep that credit rating up, and I found it, at least on a personal basis, to be a very useful thing in my own private life. And I just have been bothered a little by much of the discussion here in the last few weeks in the legislature that we ought not to really work on restoring our reserve account, and that we should, as some have said, give it all back when we are faced with these issues of having inadequate reserves considering the volatility of our tax code, which, by the way, to me, it doesn't bother me at all. I'm prepared to have more reserves so we have a little more fairness in the tax collection system that we have in the state. I believe in progressive taxation, so just a comment. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative
Larpless. Madam Chair, can I say something real quick?
Where is that coming from? Oh, sorry. I'm looking around the table.
I just wanted to add something to what,
yes,
what
please.
Margaret said.
Yes, please.
In looking at the report card from at least Moody's and S&P, we do score the lowest grades when it comes to this measure, the reserve level. So while these may be just small steps back towards AAA, I'll quote Tom Stinson from Senate Finance last week. He said, It may be a small step, but it's still the right thing to do.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Representative Lapa.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, when I think about this, I think about it in terms of budget stability. And you have two sides to the budget, which is the revenue side, which this committee spends most of its time on, although we do spend money and tax expenditures. But to what degree are there measures that we at the state use or that we should look at more broadly on the expenditure side? And I'm thinking as you're planning out, you have to look at demand as well. And for example, we have, I think it's probably 8,000 to 10,000 kids on the waiting list for basic sliding fee child care assistance. So if you were going to have an ideal way of predicting budget stability, you would only have to project out the bursts and just accommodate that kind of natural growth. But when we have so many areas with long waiting lists, that really kind of skews the planning side on the expenditure side. And are there models that we use internally or that we should be looking at in terms of measuring that pressure on our ability to establish true budget stability?
Ms. Kelly.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, the best we do on the budgeting side comes to the spending side of the forecast, where there are specific areas of the state budget where the legislature has decided that the eligibility is set in law, and if you meet the eligibility requirements, the state will fund the cost of those services. So our health care programs, some of our welfare programs, our education programs. And then the decision is, to the extent that those forecasted programs are growing relatively quickly or taking up a greater share of the budget, to what extent do we want to make changes to manage the amount that we actually spend, or do we increase revenues to meet that demand? other areas of spending, like you mentioned, waiting lists for childcare, adoption assistance, are not forecasted, and so we have budget pressures there that get addressed through the biennial process of allocating amongst priorities.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Kelly, is there any way in which you at the MMB try to catalog and assess those things that are not forecasted but for which the agencies have, you know, significant information about that undermet demand based on current policy, where we've chosen to do waiting lists rather than change eligibility so it matches up?
Ms. Kelly. Madam Chair, Representative Laufer, other than the budget decision-making process where those issues come before you in terms of the governor's budget recommendations, that's the most structured process we have.
And I really hate to do this, but we have to leave this room because another committee is coming in. And so there are more people on the list with questions, and we're going to ask them to just ask Pew directly and Mr. Shepner and Ms. Kelly directly. And I just really want to thank the presentation, but really, Pew, for being here. We really appreciate, and I encourage members to really take a look at their work on this issue and so many more. So thank you so much for being with us. And with that, members, we're adjourned.